For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week it's my great pleasure to bring you the results of the RNIB Writing Competition. As usual, the competition attracted an abundance of entries. The theme this year was connections. There were two categories, poetry and prose. So sit back and enjoy this collection of great writing from the Sight Loss community. First off, let's explore poetry. Entries for the poetry category could be a maximum of 30 lines long, but otherwise, our budding bards were encouraged to explore their creativity as they saw fit. Judging their efforts were poet Liz Berry and last year's winner Helen Elsley. So, before we hear their verdict, let's remind ourselves of Helen's winning entry from 2017.
Anniversary by Helen Elsley. On my desk, a small stone, a peaver, sits as if on a numbered square and marks time. I balanced, leaned and scooped it up, a minding of the still day, the shore stretched out, a clear arc of sand and space, and a distant dog that danced and barked on the wave edge as a dark, stuttering dot. That you were there after too long away, and took your shoes off to walk in the slow spread of a shallow tide which sent out its effervescent frill over ripples set in sand and washed back around a miniature island of sea-smoothed quartz. I set it up, my tiny pebble Ebenezer, to this fine day when we walked until the din of loss was nothing but a tinny far-off voice calling to a dog or child. I set it square, and hope to prompt an anniversary in memory or return.
That was Anniversary by Helen Elsley. I hope that's whetted your appetite for this year's outstanding poems. Our judges selected a winner and two runners-up. So here in reverse order is the result of the poetry category of the 2018 RNIB Writing Competition. In third place, it's Half Integer by Alan Robert, described by Liz Berry as a beautiful idea, that of love at first sense, written with ambition.
Half Integer by Alan Robert. Can sense you approaching. Feel your steps vibrating, echoing through the still ether, yet hurried, suggesting a profile of great stature. An outline without depth, till we touch, finger to finger, as in La Creazione di Adamo. With warm breath on my face, you talk, I listen. Shivers, tingling, quivering from nape down to my coccyx. Words oozing from your lips, increases lilt from my heart. In my life, a partial existence where rainbows fly without tacitility, while abstracts can never exist without a framework of conception. Though I can feel birdsong, view breeze whispering to time immemorial, for I read of your presence from what I form from pheromones, reverberations, reflections of my ego. And tarrying to gather senses, I can see to infinity and beyond, across the plains of Peridolia where we come together. There, everything means nothing. Nothing is imprisoned, but free. Can sense your departure. Feel your steps fading.
That was Half Integer by Alan Robert. And in second place, it's The Day You Took My Hand by Sarah Evans. Judge Helen Elsley said of this poem, "The writer uses spare, controlled phrases to convey the sense of constriction and underlying fear in the situation. Those who have been there will recognise it instantly."
The Day You Took My Hand by Sarah Evans. Lying prone, inhaling iodine, mind made muzzy by pre-med, eyelids forced open, head cushioned firmly into place. Please try not to move. Eyes black hole wide, gazing into bright, blinding from the coming scalpel cut, removing clouds of dimming vision. Someone took my hand, warm contact, skin on skin, a thumb stroke across my palm, a calming touch along blue worm veins, sheltering me from the storms of fear, steering me safely through the black night present, until I reach the light.
That was The Day You Took My Hand by Sarah Evans. And now, the winner of the poetry category in the 2018 RNIB Writing Competition is Salt by Alexia Sloane. Liz Berry described this poem as wild, sensual, and vivid. We were all immediately enchanted by this poem and the spell it cast.
Salt by Alexia Stone. I want to lose my breath in you, my delicate Pacific, then come up for air slowly, speckled with the salt and sea foam of your skin. I am a giant jellyfish, Medusa, all gnawed, snake tentacles and ricochet eyes and pinkish muscle, hoarse with sand, here to brand your rocks with my own waves. Perhaps I will see myself inside you, mirror, mirror, be turned into your salt crystals by my own gaze. We are at once an ocean and a submarine, unseen beneath the radiance of waves, sheets, each other's desert island, raft, shaft in air and coral reef, to slip through into the tsunami's silence we have scattered out of song and stillness.
Breathtaking. Salt by Alexia Sloane. And, as I discovered when I spoke to Alexia, poetry is not her only contribution to the creative arts. Alexia Sloane, welcome to Read On, and many congratulations for winning the RNIB poetry competition.
Thank you so much.
You must be delighted.
Yeah, I was extremely surprised. There are so many amazing, like, blind poets in the community that, I wasn't expecting it to be me.
Well, it's a beautiful, wild, vivid poem. Where did you find the inspiration?
I'm very interested in kind of the role of art as activism and as kind of non-violent protest in society. When I showed that poem to a few people, they tended to say something like, well, it's not really activism, it's just a love poem. And I thought, well, is there a reason why romantic poetry shouldn't be activist-y? And it was inspired by LGBT issues and things, so I saw that as a form of activism.
Some of our listeners will already know your name because you feature in Connect magazine, where you're being interviewed about your work as a composer and musician. Do you see music and poetry as two halves of the same whole?
Yes, I definitely do. I think I've been in a very tricky situation recently of having to decide between studying composition at conservatoire or creative writing at university. And for me, that process has made me feel as if people see the two as separate fields. But for me, I mean, it's all art, and both inspired by similar things for me. It's just which medium I find easiest to communicate in for a particular topic.
And does the one side inspire the other?
I think so, yeah. I mean, people quite often ask me, have you tried setting your text? Usually for me that doesn't really work, because it's too spoken wordy, really, for me to be able to make coherent meter from it, for example, in music. But, yeah, I think they do inform each other. The musicality of poetry is something I find really attractive.
Which poets have inspired you in your writing?
I'm inspired by quite a range of poets. I think I mean, Sappho is probably my queen, to be honest. And then, because she was also one of the first to include lyotones in her music, so in her poetry readings. So there's a kind of connection of spoken word and music and lyric poetry. But then also, I love Rilke, I love T.S. Eliot, and some more contemporary poets as well.
You must have been delighted that Helen Dunmore won the Costa Book Award, only the second poet, I think, to do so this year.
Oh, I was so happy. Helen Dunmore's amazing.
Congratulations again to Alexia and our two runners-up. If you'd like to listen to their poems again, you can access them and the winners of the prose category online at rnib.org.uk/writingcomp or by calling the RNIB info line on 0203 432 1488, then selecting the RNIB Connect menu option. If you prefer to read them in Braille, giant print or have an audio CD, then contact Tom Harmsworth on 0845 330 3723. And stay tuned for the result of the prose category of this year's RNIB writing competition.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
Patrick Gale is the acclaimed author of 15 novels, including Notes from an Exhibition, Rough Music, and A Place Called Winter. He's also written two collections of short stories, which are by turns darkly funny, spooky, and captivating, which makes him the perfect choice to be the chair of judges for the prose category of this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition. Patrick Gale, welcome to Read On.
Thank you, Ron.
Why do you think that in the States the short story is held in equal esteem to the novel and over here it's always been a bit of a subgenre almost?
Yes, it's very odd that I think it's down to prestige, I think it's down to The New Yorker, actually. The New Yorker and a few other... America does have this very strong tradition going right back to the 19th century of newspapers and magazines regularly commissioning short fiction from very established authors. We do it in England to a much lesser extent, and it tends to be something that just happens at Christmas or whatever, whereas every issue of The New Yorker will have a short story. And I think that tradition has built up this expectation in the public, and it's built up a big readership. So when you talk to publishers in the UK, they will always roll their eyes when you mention short stories, and they say, well, they never sell. I think they would sell if we had more impetus behind them. So whenever I have the chance, I bang on to prize committees about the importance of short story prizes, not though for single short stories like the RNIB is so wonderfully doing here, but prizes for whole collections, because I think that's what makes it commercial. If a publisher had the equivalent of the Booker Prize for a collection of short stories, they would be encouraging writers to do more of them.
The idea of writing a novel, I think, for many people is so daunting that they'll never attempt, and yet the idea of writing a 1,000-word story is something that most people could...
It's less overwhelming, isn't it, as a prospect? And the other nice thing with a short fiction is you can carry it around in your head and mull it over for days before starting. You can hold the whole thing in your head at once, whereas with a novel it's like trying to hold architectural plans in your head. You can't picture the whole building in one go. Much trickier.
You're the chair of judges for the prose category of the RNIB writing competition this year. What advice have you got for our budding Raymond Carvers?
I think my only advice would be read the story out loud to yourself. Really make sure it works as a narrative that you can tell. And if you're inhibited, if you're quite new to writing fiction, just bear in mind that we all tell stories all the time when we're talking. So if you're nervous about the actual writing process, have a go at simply recording yourself telling the story and then type it up. And that can often break that inhibition. I frequently do this with writing students. If I feel they're putting on a special writing voice when they write, I remind them that actually they're far more fluent when they speak, and it's that fluency that they need to work at on the page.
It's very interesting you say that, because as one of your fellow judges and somebody who has sat on the panel for a few years now, and being blind, I always have to listen to the stories being read by someone else. The ones that end up as finalists are the ones that flow when they're read out loud. And it's not just me selecting them. It's the other sighted judges who obviously pick up that cadence through reading it off the page.
Oh, no, totally. I always maintain that English prose has a meter to it, just as poetry does. And it's often only by reading your work out loud, even if you're just reading it in your head, that you notice where you've hobbled the meter, where it doesn't flow naturally. It's also a very good exercise giving your work to someone else and having them read it back to you, because if they find it hard to read, if their tongue stumbles over certain phrases, the chances are someone's brain will also stumble on reading those phrases, and it's a very good corrective.
Do you like hearing your own work read as audiobooks? Or...
I hate it. I absolutely hate it. But I know it's a cherished form of delivering fiction these days. And funnily enough, I'm going to spend most of this year recording my own novels. I've recently done a deal with a new publisher who's bought up all my Comet Tale of a backlist, so some 16 novels, many of which have never been recorded, and I'm going to be recording them all. So I'll have to get used to my discomfort at the sound of my own voice.
Your books have a very strong sense of place. You live and work in Cornwall. Is that something else that you look for in other people's writing?
Yes, I do. It's not obligatory, but I like it when a writer evokes place with the same care that they evoke character, because the place where the characters live will have shaped them, and it should feel like an extra character in the book. I'm sure we can all think of examples of novels like Rebecca, where you have this very powerful sense of place, or indeed any of the Bronte novels. And I think it's not a thing to be done automatically. It's a thing to be taken as seriously as you take the building of your characters.
In a short story, do you feel that there should always be some kind of closure or an ending?
No, not at all. I think some very good short stories leave you hanging to some extent. They carry on growing in your head after you finish the book, the story, precisely because the writer hasn't given a tidy closure. Sometimes a short story can simply focus on the crisis point. It could be something as simple as a conversation between a husband and wife that's revealing things that aren't resolved within the story. A thing to bear in mind with writing short fiction as well is pace. I don't mean so much pace in the thriller sense, so much as pace of the speed at which the narrative passes. Because just because a story is very short doesn't mean it can only cover a very short period. You can cover an entire life in 3 pages. It's just a matter of what you focus in on. And I always warn people when talking about this to think about dialogue. Because when you write dialogue, it's often the only time in your writing where the writing is moving at the same snail pace of real life. Dialogue may feel fast to you as a writer, but actually it's very slow. It's real life speed. So you can get trapped in dialogue. It can be very, very slow. So always bear in mind there are those gear changes where you can step out of direct speech into indirect speech, or even further into reported speech, and speed your narrative car up a little.
Well, I think that's some fantastic pointers and pieces of advice. Patrick Gale, thank you for being a guest on Read On.
My pleasure, Ed.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, bringing you the results of this year's RNIB writing competition. We've already heard the results of the poetry category, so now it's time for the prose. But before we hear this year's top 3, let's remind ourselves of last year's winner, Many Happy Returns by A.C. Hart.
Many Happy Returns by A.C. Hart. She was getting very tired now. The life which was inside her, the life which was her, was becoming heavier by the mile. As the wine dark sea appeared before her, she looked around for familiar landmarks. They would have changed, of course. Naturally, over a period of 500 years, most things did change. Just those flimsy temporary constructions that man had made. But sometimes even the lands themselves would have vanished and islands come and gone. Once, many thousands of years ago, she had seen for herself a fiery mountain destroy an island and all who lived upon it. Once she had returned and all the land itself had been covered by water, but still she continued to keep her appointment, renewing herself in the holy flames once every half millennium. Only she remained immutable. To her right, she saw the few signs of a world long gone. To her left, she saw the bones of a civilization even older, but she was straining to sight the land which was the cradle of them all. It had been a long time, but in the distance, far over the waves below her, she finally saw the coast which marked the land of her own birth. Gradually, she made out the details, and she was heartened to see once again her old friend, the Sphinx, still guarding the vast tombs of ancient rulers. But like herself, the Sphinx was many millennia older than those ephemeral kings. The years and many, many visits showed their impact. The intricate patterns of trackways, canals, and temples had been fading for nearly 2,000 years and were hardly recognizable. Gone was the tall building which guided men's ships from miles around. In its place was a maze of new squalid buildings, which she knew would not be there the next time she came to this place. They were just the products of those short-lived men who, frightened of being forgotten, had built such edifices as the crumbling pyramids. Where now was the dazzling white sheathing which had once protected and made them glorious? Where were the golden capstones? In this land, she was known as the Bennu. Men from China knew her as the Feng Huang. In India, she was called the Garuda. In Tibet, the Mi Bi Kamo. In Russia, the Firebird. And in nearby Greece, her name had been the Phoenix. But in this place was her true home, and she was almost there. Once every 500 years, she would return from her lonely wanderings to her temple at Heliopolis. There, her fiery death and the sacrificial flame gave her rebirth. Then, once more, she would fly high over the world, journeying even as far as the homes of the gods themselves. Now, again, the anniversary of her death was upon her. As she winged her way over that country where lay her destiny, instead of a handsome marble-built temple, she saw mean grey huts and a large narrow field which men called an airport. It was an ugly and noisy sight, but she was not perturbed by the constant coming and going of large metallic machines. If she did not wish them to, they could neither see her nor touch her. Now her burden was almost too heavy to bear. She must find the altar where she would meet the end, which was also her beginning. No matter what changes had ever been made, the old gods had always provided for her the temple and the flame. She knew that she would find it. She circled and circled until at last she spied the object of her quest. The ancient handsome temple had gone, and the once golden-arched portal had been rebuilt. Now the temple was a humble concrete construction, but she recognized her shrine immediately. There was no mistaking the two golden arches which marked the entrance. Unseen, she flew inside where many white and red-garbed priests were ministering to her worshippers, to the accompaniment of monotonous, loud music. But she did not care about this. She sought her altar and her fire. As if by magic or the will of the gods, at that very moment, a priest in a tall white hat opened a small door beneath the great altar. There was her eternal flame. Summoning up her last energies, she made herself undetectable, and she flew into the flames for her final and first act. Unknowingly, the priest closed the door behind her.
"No more flame-grilled chicken, boss,"
shouted a greasy, bored youth. In response, a large, swarthy man stomped up to the oven and opened the door to check. One glance was enough to rouse his considerable anger.
"What sort of idiots are they sending me these days? Who put that bird in there without it being plucked?"
he barked at the disinterested boy.
"It's ruined! All that's left are a few charred bones and a pile of flashy-looking feathers,"
he ranted at no one in particular.
"Hello. What's this? What's this odd-looking egg doing in here? Well, I'm not going to have any more money wasted today," he thundered. "Here, take it away and turn it into mayo or something. These ignorant foreigners will never know the difference. All they are interested in is getting their stomachs filled as quickly as possible and then doing more sightseeing."
And he stomped off, muttering darkly to himself. As he broke the egg containing the essence of the one and only phoenix, and as he proceeded to obliterate the contents and their future, the youth listened idly to his boss, still venting his frustrations.
"Years of study and our proud history, and here I am tending to dilettante tourists. Our culture has been sold to the highest bidder. Nobody gives a thought to the things of real value these days. How long before even they are lost?"
Sizzlingly good stuff. Now, without further ado, to this year's competition. As with the poems, the theme was connections, with the competition open to anyone with sight loss. Entries could be fiction or non-fiction and up to 1,000 words long. But, as you'll hear, you can get a lot of story into 1,000 words. I was lucky enough to be on the panel of judges, which was chaired by Patrick Gale, who you can hear discussing his own prize-winning novels and short stories in a previous episode of Read On. All of us were bowled over by the high standard of entries again this year, but, like the judges in the poetry section, we too had to pick a winner and two runners-up. So, again in reverse order, here's the result of the prose category of the 2018 RNIB Writing Competition. In third place, it's Connections by Charlotte Lilly. Along with the other judges, I enjoyed the contrast between Gordon's world-weary cynicism and Pam's indomitable humanity, which creates a nice tension that makes the ending even more satisfying. See what you think.
Connections by Charlotte Lilly. "Terminal," they said. He nodded. It didn't come as a shock. His body had slowly started giving up, and so had he. Those endless chemotherapy sessions had all been for nothing. The prickly feeling as the UV was connected to his arm, and the cold, clammy sickness he experienced afterwards. The headaches and the nausea. That was the drugs working, they said. How very wrong they had been. A leaflet was thrust into his hand. "Helping Hands Hospice." How depressing, he thought. Is this what it had come to? The glossy pamphlet showed patients smiling, painting, and drinking tea whilst they waited to die. He didn't want to go, but what choice did he have? He was all alone. No wife, no children. An only child, his parents had passed on long ago. He could barely take care of himself, hence the reason for the home help nurse who visited twice a day. "You'll get picked up tomorrow at 9 a.m. and taken to the hospice's day centre for a trial to see how you get on. Give it a try. You might like it." The doctor smiled at him. Not likely, he thought. But he thanked her for her time and headed for the number 9 bus stop. His 30-minute journey home was clouded in misery. It was a bitter, dark evening, and it matched his mood perfectly. At home, he lit the open fire and sat down in his threadbare armchair, the only thing that had been a constant in his life. His eyes began to feel heavy, The day's events had taken their toll on him, and he drifted off into a deep slumber. What on earth? He was startled from his sleep by the relentless ringing of his front doorbell. As he opened the door, a portly gentleman with greying hair and round glasses smiled back at him.
All ready to go, Mr. Porter?
Go where? He asked.
To the hospice, sir. I was asked to pick you up at 9 a.m. It's now 9:05, he said, very matter-of-fact.
Oh, that. Yes. Well, let me just get my things. He didn't bother to change his clothes. What was the point? After all, he was dying, so it didn't matter what people thought of his unkempt appearance. Their opinions would be redundant once he was gone. The journey to the hospice was a silent one. His driver had tried to make small talk, but he didn't feel like reciprocating. He didn't need to make friends. His time on Earth would soon be up. So again, what was the point? The day centre was bright. Too bright, he thought, as he walked through the double doors. Watercolour paintings of canal scenes adorned the walls, whilst unfinished jigsaws lay scattered on tables. There was a stack of board games in the far corner of the room, and knitting needles and wool in the other. He made his way over to a beige chair with a plump purple cushion and sat down. A crossword book sat on the table next to him. He had always liked puzzles, so started a new page and began to fill in the blanks.
Excuse me, you're in my seat.
He glanced over the top of his crossword to see a frail elderly woman peering at him through her oversized gold-rimmed glasses.
You deaf? I said, that's my seat, she screeched in her Cockney accent. Look, that's my bag.
She pointed to a garish shopper to the side of the chair. He got up. He couldn't be bothered to argue, and plonked himself down in the adjacent seat.
You knew?
She asked. He loathed small talk. Yes, he said curtly.
Could have dressed up a bit. What's your name?
He heaved a heavy sigh. Gordon.
I'm Pam, she smiled.
He nodded, hoping the conversation would end. No such luck.
So, what you doing? Crossword? I ain't no good at them.
They keep my brain active, he retorted.
EastEnders does that too,
she laughed, before launching into a coughing fit.
Excuse me, my lungs ain't what they used to be. Lung cancer, she said. It's my own fault for taking up smoking in the first place, but when you're young, you just don't think, do you? Now I've got me grandkids and me husband Bill, and I'm going to have to leave them all behind. Doc says I've got about 6 months left.
She dabbed at her eyes. He glanced at her bag and noticed a keychain adorned with the words Star Baker. Do you cook? He asked, in an attempt to change the subject and avoid another show of emotion.
Oh, I love to cook, me. Especially a sausage plait or a good old toad in the hole.
As she talked about her love of food and cookery shows, her eyes began to light up. She reached in her bag and pulled out a piece of scrap paper.
Here, you can have this.
She thrust it into his hand.
Me mum's recipe, that was. Shepherd's pie. Dead easy to make. Just follow them instructions and make sure you make it, because I'll be asking you next week.
He smiled. Over the course of the day, he listened as she talked about her grandchildren, her husband, who she got married to, aged just 16, and her upbringing, She had been one of 12, and her parents had struggled to put meals on the table. In return, he told her about his job as an accountant, the long hours he had worked, and how his job had cost him the one thing that meant the most to him, Elsie, his one true love. When he lost her, he became somewhat of a recluse. In all his 74 years, he had never opened up to anyone like he did that afternoon to Pam. As he left the hospice, he clutched the recipe she had given him and vowed to make it that night. This time, his car journey home was full of chatter, so much so his driver couldn't believe it was the same man he had picked up earlier that morning. At home, he followed the recipe to a T and lapped up the lot. As he sunk into his armchair that evening, he felt content. He had made a connection, and for once, it wasn't with the chemotherapy machine. "I can't wait to go to the hospice next week," he thought. And as he closed his eyes, he smiled before everything turned black.
That was Connections by Charlotte Lilly, a runner-up in the RNIB writing competition. And in second place, it's Rachel Marsh with New Connections. Patrick Gale praised how the story deftly hones in on a problem so many other people have faced, of feeling themselves isolated by technology and pride, but then heartwarmingly undermines our expectations, showing that positive change and personal development can surprise at any age. Here's New Connections by Rachel Marsh.
New Connections by Rachel Marsh. Reggie sighed and looked up as he heard the clock strike 4. He put down his book and cursed at how long it took him to stand up. His knee operation couldn't come soon enough. He shuffled into the kitchen and put the kettle on. He got out one cup, one saucer, and the chocolate biscuits, which he never ate. They had been Mabel's favourites. Reggie still bought them every week, but they were never wasted. His grandchildren were more than willing to eat them. He looked at the calendar. 3 more days until he would see his grandchildren again. The constant loneliness was an unwanted presence in his life, unless Eileen was in, doing her cleaning. She had been Mabel's best friend, and before she died, she had asked Eileen to come in regularly to look after him. He had been annoyed at first, and embarrassed, but now he had to admit that Eileen's cheery presence in the mornings was rather pleasant. She put him to shame with her energy. But then again, she was much healthier physically. "You need to live on a bit more than soup," Eileen would scold him gently. Honestly, he had had enough of all that in his ear from the doctor. Charlotte was just as bad. "Dad, you can't just eat dinner on Sundays. You need to eat well during the week, too." He usually grunted in response. Apart from cooking on Sundays, what was the point? Sundays were wonderful. The children still begged him to do the Ted, Frog and Rabbit game that he had made up years ago. He kept the 3 toys carefully. They were beautifully made, and Reggie had created their characters for the children years ago. Teddy spoke German, Frog spoke French, and Rabbit spoke Spanish. The game was that hilarity and confusion abounded when each one couldn't understand the other. He made it simple for the children, of course. He used English phrases as well so the children could understand and join in. It was a fun way to connect with his grandchildren and to remember his years of teaching languages. He had thought they would be bored of it by now. But no. "Can I film you, Grandad?" Charlie had requested a few weeks ago.
You can film on that thing?
Reggie had looked at the slender device that Charlie never seemed to be without.
Yeah, we could put it online.
Why?
'Cause you're funny. We can watch it during the week when we don't see you.
He had obliged and made up another story of Ted, Frog and Rabbit, switching fluently and effortlessly from language to language while the children roared in delight. That was his life now, living for Sundays. The phone rang and he shuffled through to the living room to answer it.
Hello?
Grandad, it's me.
Charlie's voice made him smile and he sat down on the sofa.
Hello, Charlie. How are you?
Reggie struggled to understand the shrill voice coming from the receiver.
Sorry, Charlie. I didn't catch that.
You've gone viral, he squeaked.
Viral? I'm not ill, Charlie. What made you think that?
He heard a screech of laughter.
No, Grandad. Viral means on the internet. I posted that video up of you, but I never thought we'd get this many views.
Oh, I see.
Reggie gave a chuckle.
That's nice, Charlie.
Grandad, you're going to be famous. Mum's had people ringing here for you. Here, Mum wants to speak to you.
Charlie disappeared from the phone.
Dad?
Charlotte's soothing voice came on the line.
Hello, love. Charlie seems rather excited.
It's true, you know. We have had agents trying to get in contact with you. I think they want you to develop the idea and turn it into a book or TV show. Don't you think that's amazing?
Reggie struggled to catch a breath.
But that's... I mean, it was never...
he stammered.
I don't understand how this thing works. How did lots of people see it?
Dad, calm down. We'll discuss it on Sunday. I'll inform the people who are calling that we'll be in touch. This has come as a surprise to all of us.
But I can't do anything like that.
Why not? Reggie could hear Charlie cheering in the background and Jake and Vicky laughing.
What's Charlie doing?
Oh, he's doing somersaults on the settee. Stop that, Charlie, and calm down, for goodness sake.
Look, Dad, I'd better go. Don't worry about it now, but just think what Mum would have said.
Okay. Bye, love.
Love you, she said.
Reggie replaced the receiver and sighed. What would Mabel have said? She would have been excited, just like Charlie. She also would have said he was a silly old fool for not wanting to go anywhere or see anyone during the week. It was a painful realization. Perhaps it was time to start making some new connections. A sense of peace settled over him, and he slept for a while. When he woke, he picked up the phone and dialed.
Hello, Eileen? Reggie, are you all right?
The concern in her voice was touching.
Yes, I just wondered if you would care to join me for dinner tonight.
There was silence.
Eileen? Sorry, you took me by surprise. Are you sure? Yes. For soup?
Eileen said, and laughed.
No, not tonight, he replied,
and laughed as well.
Is 6:30 okay?
Yes. Thank you, Reggie. I'll see you later.
Reggie replaced the receiver. He shuffled back into the kitchen and smiled as he reached for one of the chocolate biscuits.
That was New Connections by Rachel Marsh, second place in this year's RNIB writing competition. But now it's time for the winner. Holding Centre 5 by Sherilee Rogan. In his judges' comments, Patrick Gale applauded Sherilee's story as startlingly original and darkly funny. Using very clear language, it drew the listener in, bewildered them, surprised them, then left them with a nasty chill. No mean feat in under 2 pages.
Holding Centre 5 by Sherilee Rogan. The convoy paused in front of the high gates and a wire fence that stretched off in either direction. When its ID was verified, the gates opened automatically and the convoy drove through. Immediately, uniformed attendants emerged from the buildings to herd the people climbing down from the back of the trucks into an anxious crowd in the centre of the yard. Most were elderly, but others were younger and looked around them warily. Ramps were brought out and a few of the new arrivals rolled down them in wheelchairs. Several clutched long white canes or walked beside guide dogs and were guided to the rest of the group by attendants, who took their arms. Finally, a few people, deeply unconscious, were wheeled out on stretchers. None of them were well-dressed. Most looked unkempt and undernourished. Their faces thin and hunted-looking, their clothes ragged and worn. The young woman sat at the table, where she had been brought and left after waking. She was gaunt and dishevelled, tense and watchful, her eyes large within the hollows of her face. She massaged her arms where they were sore and faintly bruised from the restraints she'd been told were there to stop her hurting herself. Mistrustfully, she eyed the man who entered the room and sat opposite her. He was younger and looked groomed and well-fed. Laura regarded him with hostility. "I'm John," he said. "Your interpreter?" "Laura," she replied reluctantly after a pause. John smiled at her, then frowned, noticing the bruises. "I'm sorry your arrival here was so traumatic." Laura glanced down at her own arms and frowned too. "The people who came to my house, they sedated me," she said sullenly. "You resisted your collection. I'm afraid sedation was necessary to get you here safely," John said apologetically. Laura glared at John and then looked away anxiously, biting her lip. "Why do I need an interpreter?" she asked eventually. John smiled again. "It's usual for disconnected persons like yourself to be confused when you arrive at the centre. We've found interpreters reassuring." "Disconnected persons?" Nervously, Laura pulled at the sleeves of her jumper, stretching the fraying fabric down over her hands and wrapping her arms around herself. John regarded her sympathetically. "Facilities like this have been created to process people like you." "Disconnected persons," John explained. "You haven't been coping. You weren't eating properly or paying bills. You weren't communicating with other people. You had disconnected yourself from the rest of society. Now that you're here, you can be taken care of."
"What are you talking about?"
Laura asked incredulously. "I don't need to be taken care of. I don't need to be here." John looked pained. "You aren't on any social media. It's obvious that you would have struggled in normal life. That's..."
"How do you know that?"
Laura interrupted.
"That I'm not on social media?"
"Everyone can see what you're doing online, Laura," John said, sounding surprised. "Or in your case, what you don't do. Everyone's online."
"Not everyone," Laura said bitterly.
John sat back in his chair. "Most of the people on the convoy you were brought in on were elderly or had visual or physical impairments that prevented them from connecting. You're able-bodied and only in your 30s. What stopped you?" Laura sighed and looked down.
"I didn't know what to do," she said softly. "Everything moved on so fast and I couldn't keep up."
"Couldn't keep up?" John said.
Sighing, Laura's gaze drifted off into the far corner of the room as she continued. I lost my job when the system at work upgraded and I didn't have the right IT skills anymore. I tried to find another, but it was the same everywhere. Then my phone got out of date and stopped working and I couldn't get online to do anything.
Couldn't you just get a new phone? John asked.
Laura's gaze snapped back to John and she glared angrily at him.
No, you don't understand. I couldn't afford a new phone. I had no money by then. I couldn't get into my online account. I couldn't even apply for benefits because there was no office to go to or number to ring, and then it was too late.
Laura's voice started to shake a little as she spoke. Too late? John prompted her quietly. More and more things went online. I'd fallen so far behind. I didn't know what to do, and there was no way to catch up. It was like I didn't exist. Laura covered her eyes and her shoulders shook as she started to cry. John watched her silently until eventually she took a long, ragged breath and scrubbed her face with her sleeve. It must have been difficult for you, John said gently.
It felt like I had slipped out of the world, Laura said, her voice still thick. I didn't realise how easy it was to get left behind and how impossible it was to catch up.
But now that you're here, John said, none of that matters anymore. You can be taken care of.
You keep saying that, Laura said, frowning. What does that mean?
You don't have to worry about keeping up anymore. All that pressure can be taken away. All that suffering can be taken care of. Now that you're here.
Laura shifted in her chair. But I can catch up, she said nervously. I can catch up. I can't just stay here.
Don't worry, John said, smiling as he pushed back his chair and stood. Nothing that happened before matters now. You will be taken care of.
He turned away and Laura rose quickly to her feet. But what does that mean? Please tell me what that means.
As John reached the door, he turned back to Laura and smiled reassuringly. Don't worry. All disconnected persons will be taken care of.
That was Holding Centre 5 by Sherilee Rogan. Chillingly brilliant. I spoke to Sherilee shortly after her victory was announced. Sherilee Rogan, welcome to Read On and many congratulations on winning the prose category of the writing competition.
Yeah, I'm really amazed.
And you've now won twice. You won back in 2016 with Diversion.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Every now and again, I get the urge and I write something. It's always something I've enjoyed doing since I was little.
How do you write? Are you a touch typist?
Yeah, I'm a touch typer. I have a little electronic, I call it my note taker, and it speaks and I type on that. It's like a keyboard. It doesn't have a screen.
And then you listen back to what you've written?
Yeah, that's right.
It's funny because I've been on the panel of judges both times that you've won, and something that comes through really strongly is just what a good listen your stories are. And it was commented on by Patrick Gale, who's a cited novelist, and he said how good it was to listen to. So clearly you edit well by ear.
Yeah, well, I when I went blind, I stopped writing for a long time because I couldn't get used to the sort of robotic voice of my screen reader. It just didn't sound right, but this little note take that I've got, it's still robotic, but it responds a lot better to punctuation and there's more intonation in the voice. So I got back into writing.
And another feature of your writing is it takes rather dark twists on the theme. I know that for Diversion, part of it was inspired by your own experience of a coma. Where did the rather haunting theme of Holding Centre 5 come from?
Well, my frustration that the technology that I have, laptops and things, are quite out of date. And I can't afford, you know, the things of all the speech software. And so I'm getting more and more out of date and feeling more and more out of sync with the world. And I was having a conversation with a friend about that and the idea sort of popped into my head that one day we just won't be able to function in the normal world if you can't keep up, technology-wise.
Well, I must say I've found it haunting, and it has stayed with me, and I've passed it on to friends and family, which I think is always the mark of a very good short story.
Oh, I'm really pleased. Thank you.
Who are your influences? Who do you read?
Well, I read Patrick Hill. I like sci-fi and fantasy. Terry Pratchett, I like. Carlos Ruiz Zafón, I like him. Bernard Cornwell, I quite eclectic. I'll read anything, but I do like quite dark themes. Anything that's a bit twisted.
And do you listen to talking books?
Yeah. Lots of them. I've always got a book on the go.
Well, Sherilee Rogan, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and many, many congratulations again.
Thank you very much. It's been brilliant.
Congratulations again to Sherilee Rogan and to our two runners-up. And a reminder that if you'd like to listen to their stories again, you can access them and the winners of the poetry category online at rnib.org.uk/writingcomp or by calling the RNIB info line on 0203 432 1488, then selecting the RNIB Connect menu option. If you prefer to read them in Braille, giant print, or have an audio CD, then contact Tom Harmsworth on 0845 330 3723. Well done again to both our winners and the runners-up. Thanks to our judges and to everyone who entered and helped make this year's RNIB writing competition such an enjoyable and entertaining one. I'm looking forward to next year's competition already. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.